Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to You're Booked. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. My new novel, Limelight, a story of sisterhood, sexuality and self-esteem, is available nationwide. If you want to listen to it, Natalie Simpson, star of Outlander, reads it brilliantly on audiobook. If you'd like a signed, personalised hardback, you can order one from the Margate Bookshop and they deliver all over the UK. If you're listening on Monday the 19th of June, I'm going to be at Harbour Books in Whitstable tomorrow with podcast alumnus Catherine May. There might be tickets still available, drop the bookshop a line and they should be able to squeeze you in. And I'm at Waterstones, Cambridge on June the 28th with another friend of the podcast, Lucy Vine. Now, on to today's guest. Andrew Hunter Murray is a very talented man. He's a best-selling author, QI elf, host of No Such Thing as a Fish, and an ostentatious graduate. His brilliant new novel, The Sanctuary, is a taut, elegant dystopian thriller. So I was surprised and delighted when Andrew revealed himself to be a fellow Persephone addict, sorry, subscriber, and also a Dorothy Whipple fanboy. We also talked about rare editions, Douglas Adams, and whether it's possible to choose a favourite Jane Austen novel. So, Andrew, I'd like to start by asking you about dystopias. You obviously know your way around a chilling and enthralling dystopia. Did you grow up seeking those stories out, or are there any that you've read that you're a fan of?
I think I probably grew up seeking them out. I think there's something very appealing about a dystopia. I mean, not every single book, but you know, there's something very nice about a crumbling, ruined place, and I, you know, there are lots of wonderful poems about that. And yeah, I grew up with all sorts of authors like John Wyndham and you know, the kind of the 50s mob who really specialized in that kind of thing. And there is something pleasing. There's a very nice German saying which goes something like, "More beautiful than a beautiful thing are the ruins of a beautiful thing," and that's real 19th century romanticism stuff. But I think everyone can kind of empathise with that. You know, there is something magnificent about, you know, a ruined castle or whatever it is. And so I think the appeal for dystopias is it's a safe look over the precipice, and that's why they keep on appealing, even in times when the precipice actually feels quite close. Which is why they were so popular when the atomic bomb had been first developed. I think that's what people like about them.
And I think it's really interesting that you mentioned John Wyndham and those stories that we can go back and read now and think, oh gosh, what they were dreading is probably not unlike what we are dreading. You know, there is nothing new under the sun. I've just read Coming Up for Air by George Orwell, which is right before the outbreak of the Second World War. And I think, in the last sort of 90 odd years, you know, we are exactly as class obsessed and neurotic and obsessed with small things while feeling as though we should be obsessed with bigger things.
Yeah, absolutely.
As we ever were.
And I think there's a funny thing. I mean, if you look back at people who lived through the Second World War, they saw cities that they lived in destroyed, you know, or seriously damaged by actual bombing raids by people who were trying to kill them. People all over Europe had that experience, and all over the world had that experience. And, you know, people of my parents' generation remember rationing. They remember having ration cards. And I think we are always focused on the idea that everything might go wrong. And it's quite an extreme reaction because, you know, what's always more likely is that we will We will get our way out of the pickle we have just got ourselves into with the last thing we invent by using the next thing we invent. It's most of human history has been that. And obviously the stakes feel a huge amount higher now with climate change and with, you know, with all these other threats that we have. But that has broadly been our progress so far. And so you might not think it from the two books I've published so far. I am an optimist about about humanity and about our amazing abilities and, you know, all of that. That really doesn't come across in the published AHM canon.
Well, I think a pickle is a delightful way of catching it. And I was thinking about your creativity and inventiveness and skill as a world builder, a builder of destroyable worlds. And I suppose I'm curious about whether you think there's any connection at all with comedy, and you might not, in terms of establishing very vivid worlds very quickly and taking people with you.
Ooh, what a great question. You've picked up on the thing that I've been thinking about a lot recently, which is The Sanctuary, the new book, is I would say, the most serious book maybe that I'll ever write. You know, and I mean, everything else in my career has an element of the comic to it. You know, I write for Private Eye, and I worked at QI for a long time, and I still do the QI podcast. In terms of the link between the two, I think what both have in common is an ability to evoke quickly with a few details. And that's really core to any creative endeavor. If you find exactly the right detail, you can make any environment either very funny or very evocative and dystopian. And yeah, so sometimes it's a matter of just thinking of lots of different options and whittling down, or spending a good long while thinking before you commit something to the page. Because I come from an improvising tradition in comedy, you normally don't get a chance to go back and correct yourself, which is why it's so nice writing a book where you can plan for months. You don't have to commit anything to the page until you're good and ready, and that's a real treat. It doesn't sound like it, but as long as you don't spend, you know, 10 years planning one page, then yeah, it's a joy to do that.
And is that how you work? Because when I write, I often get it, I waste thousands of words and I can't go, and I've tried to plan a little bit more every time, but I often do have to write it wrong, to write it at all. But do you really work out exactly where the beats of the story fall and what the universe looks like before you actually write prose?
I have had a crack at writing from the hip, and it went awfully, and I got 30,000 words in. A lot of authors seem to say it's 30,000 words, and then you find yourself in a jam, and you can't do, as opposed to a pickle, you find yourself really stuck, and you think, oh God, I can't get any further. I don't see my way out of this. So I did 30,000 words for my first book, The Last Day, got stuck, completely took a break, paused, worked everything out this time, and started again. Because I think that the creativity comes from the way you get through each individual scene and the way you write and the details you notice along the way. So even though I know what is going to happen broadly in a scene and what plot moves might have to happen, I've no idea how they're going to happen until I'm writing. So there's a healthy dose of creativity in both parts. I think it'd be really boring to plan everything to the last detail, because then you're just having to type out your own novel, which you've already worked out all of. But I also can't cope with writing everything fresh and just putting, I think it was Evelyn Waugh who said he had the ability when he was young to just put a load of characters on a chessboard and see what happened, you know, see where they went, really. I can't do that either. So that nice thing in the middle where you've got a destination and you've got several possible routes there. Well, you've got one route there, but you can choose what you notice along the way. That's fun.
I'd love to come back to ask you about Evelyn Waugh, if he's someone that you enjoy reading.
Oh, yes. No. You've got your route map.
But you talked about improvising. Yeah. You see, this is it. I don't know what I'm doing with my chess pieces. Obviously, I would feel terrible if I didn't ask you about Ostentatious Jane Austen.
Yeah. So I was a member of a... it makes it sound like I'm a recovering member of. Until this January, I was in Ostentatious, which is an improvised Jane Austen comedy show, and the conceit is that Jane Austen didn't write six novels, she wrote 700 or 800. Hugely exciting, and we then restore these lost works to the public, the audience, and we get a title at the start of each show, and then we just go from there. So I've only just stepped back from it. So I'm still really missing it. But it's such a fun show to do. And a load of us are real Austin heads in the group. And it's, yeah, it's a complete joy.
So how did you kind of first encounter her novels?
At school, we had a very good English teacher who's probably the reason I studied English at uni and then, you know, got me into this whole thing. And he asked us all to read Emma. And that, well, it was one of the books that term. And weirdly, it's my least favourite of Austen's novels. I don't know why. Don't get me wrong, still love it. But it's the one I would take last to the desert island.
I feel like Emma is always a favourite or a least favourite. No one feels indifferently about
it. I mean, it's all, the thing is, every page of Austen is funny and good and contains brilliant stuff. Maybe it's the character of Emma herself. She's just a bit, she's a bit Marmite for a lot of people. But anyway, so and then, you know, enjoyed Emma and then read lots more Austen at university because I did English. And you get to pick a special author. You do a whole term on one author. And I picked Austen and was one of about three boys, I think, in the whole, like, this very large lecture theatre of students wanting to study Austen, which is a shame. I think more men should read Austen. I'm a big advocate of that. I mean, so many books are kind of divided arbitrarily on lines of what people think they should be reading or what publishers think readers should like in particular categories. I mean, there's so much humanity in all of Jane Austen that it's a crying shame.
The thrill of discovering she's funny, yeah, and that funniness doesn't stop. I was trying to work out the sort of, I guess, like the mechanics of Pride and Prejudice and the A plot and the B plot and how the story is woven, and thinking, oh, but it all comes from characters, really. There's nothing very much external that's driving everyone. Everyone's driving themselves and driving each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the other thing I love about the way Austen's characters operate, I think of it as a kind of, there's a kind of solid core of two or three people, always the heroine and one or two others, who are fully human and fully fleshed out and truly the most psychologically real in the whole book. And then you're allowed a little bit of eccentricity in the characters around them, like Mrs. Bennet. And then you get to people like the Reverend Collins or Lady Catherine de Bourgh, and they're allowed to be fully bananas within Austen's particular world. And that's great fun because it allows you, you can step the comedy up to heights of absurdity, or you can step it back down and still have the very human comedy that, you know, Lizzie and Darcy have. And that's such a treat. And I think that's why it works as ostentatious on stage, is because we're operating in Austen's world, and that's how it functions, you know. You've got Miss Bates, but you've also got Mr. Knightley. You know, they're very different in levels of kind of silliness, and their amount of stage time is rationed out accordingly. Yeah, I mean, she's a genius, obviously. Oh, yeah, sorry. It's like newsflash. Austen's pretty good. Yeah.
This is always a reductive question, but do you have a favourite?
It's either Pride and Prejudice or Persuasion.
Pride and Prejudice. I thought you're allowed to breathe.
Yeah. The amount I say it, you know, it's just a time saving device. I would waste hours a day if I had to say Pride and Prejudice out, you know, fully every time. So yeah.
That is fair enough. I'd love to ask you about other funny books that you've enjoyed. Was there a particular book that was the first that you picked up as a young reader and thought, oh, this is allowed, you can be funny in books?
I think, like a lot of readers, it was The Hitchhiker's Guide. My parents have an incredibly ancient edition, which is a really, really cheap paperback, completely falling apart, paper very yellow, tiny font. And I read that and was blown away. And I was, must have been about seven, and I couldn't believe how good it was. Didn't get half the jokes, but I knew they were funny somehow, even if I didn't understand why. Yeah, I think that was the gateway.
Gosh, because I think, you know, it's a book that so many of us come to when we are quite young, but seven is, I think, a very early time to discover that.
I hope
that.
I'm not massaging it, yeah.
Was it the first book you read that felt like it was for adults, or had you been reading Proust for many years?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, I remember there were these collections of stories for, you know, there were short stories for children who are seven and over, or stories for children who are eight and over. I felt this kind of insane pride if I was eight and I read the stories for children who were nine and over. I thought, yeah,
Puffin ones, and they had the number on the front, and lots of sort of beautiful tiny illustrations of other things kind of woven around the number.
Yeah, I think it was those.
I remember those.
And so that was definitely encouraging competitive reading, which probably didn't do any harm, you know. I definitely had a crack at a few that I was too young for. Didn't get on with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest at the age of about 13 or 14. too out there, couldn't hack it, and then went back later and loved it. So yeah,
I love that when you saddle up, you're thrown off by the book and you're like, no, I will, the time will come. I think it's a really comforting thing about life to know that I think so, that we're not ready for the books, but they will wait for us and they will be ready for
us.
Yeah,
I had that with Middlemarch actually. You know, you hear it's the great, and I had a crack at it when I was a student, when I had all the time in the world. Your job is just to read novels and think about them and write about them, and I couldn't get into it. I thought, I got 200 pages in. I put a bit of time in, and it's about, I don't know, that's about a quarter of the way in, and still was getting absolutely nothing from it. And then I read it in lockdown, and you know, I had the full conversion experience and couldn't believe how good it was.
Oh well, because I've never read it, and I have always been, you know, daunted by it. And thought, oh, one day.
It is daunting.
I talked about this on the podcast before, but after having The Fear, I read Bleak House this winter.
Ooh.
Which made me feel like I could probably read Middlemarch.
Yeah, how's that? How's Bleak House?
Do it the same way. parts are really compelling. Okay. And again, Dickens is, you forget, he can be really, really funny. I did struggle with Esther, the heroine, okay, which I don't think is her fault. I think it's his fault. I think Dickens didn't do a brilliant job. And the way he writes about sort of the female friendship, it's a little bit creepy, and Esther is just too good. And I say that as a Fanny Price apologist.
Big fan of Fanny Price. Can I just say, like Fanny Price?
Thank you.
I'm, and Mansfield Park is probably next on the list after my first two fave Austens. It's really good. It is quite long, Mansfield Park, but I do think it's very good. No, I've never tackled Bleak House. I've had two goes at Moby Dick and fallen back both times. Same with Don Quixote. So there are plenty of biggies out there still waiting to be knocked off. But that's fun. I like having them kind of in the waiting room.
I think, Rhett, and there will be times, you know, lockdown.
Oh, God.
Being...
There won't be more lockdowns, please.
No, I'm sure. Not that.
Longers.
Good things. Yeah. Good things will happen. Good reasons to tackle the big giant
hospitalizations.
Books.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Comas. No, that doesn't work. How do you choose what you're going to read next?
It's a real mishmash. I try and knock off a couple of biggies a year. And I'm a subscriber to a thing called Persephone Books, which is great. They do a lot of sort of mid-century novels by mostly women writers who've mostly been undeservedly forgotten. And if you sign up for a 6 months in advance, they send you one a month. And that kind of sets a bit of your reading because you know, oh, there's another Persephone arriving this month. Great. That's really nice.
Always, always thrilled to hear a nice mention for Persephone books
great.
On the podcast because I adore them. Yeah. And I don't subscribe, but I should. But my big reading discovery of last year was Dorothy Whipple, who I am now obsessed with. I don't know if she, her biography might have been a subscriber edition. It might have called Late in the Day, that's Tessa Hadley. But she writes quite moralistic, but hugely entertaining. They are sort of their time, but also very, very fresh. There's a lightness to them, and they're not, you know, rolling around funny, but they are funny. My favourite is probably called High Wages, and it's about Jane, who needs to move out and gets a job in a draper's and lives just outside Manchester and ends up sort of running a retail empire. It's brilliant, brilliant fun. And her book, Random Commentary, Dorothy Whipple's book, which is a collection of her journals, I guess. It's the best book about writing I've ever read. And I think it goes up until the end of the end of the Second World War.
Okay.
And it's all very like, oh, it's not fair. I keep being interrupted. People keep coming in for tea. When am I going to write? And then I've had 3 days by myself and I've not written a word. And the sort of the enormous, the highs and lows. And, you know, some of her books are made into quite big films.
Yeah. The last of hers I read was They Knew Mr. Knight, which is about this family who are ordinary. They're slightly on a downward slope, but they're pretty kind of prosperous middle class people, you know. And then they come into contact with a kind of mysterious wealthy local neighbor called Mr. Knight, and the dad of the family gets more and more involved in him, and hero worships him and can't believe what a great guy he is, and accidentally gets sucked into this whirlpool of big wealth and not fully understanding what's going on. And obviously there's a reckoning coming, but just because you can see it coming doesn't mean it's any less powerful when it does come. It's a brilliant book.
There's something about her interiors that really reminds me of Anita Bruckner. And I'm thinking about all those parts of the book where they go to see the Knight family, and yeah. they've got that beautiful house, but everything just feels a little bit overstuffed and heavy and overheated, yeah. and everything's a bit overripe and sticky, and there's just too much, and they're entranced by it, but there's no flow of life there.
Yeah. It's very Robert Maxwell-y as well. Yeah. Well, I'm very interested in the rich and how they present themselves and how they appear in novels. You know, it's fascinating seeing characters who are, you get a sense the author is saying too wealthy, because most authors are not billionaires. They're always presented from outside, and it's very interesting the way authors show you the interiors or the exteriors of the wealthy and try and get under their skins and find out what they mean.
I mean, like the rest of the world, I love Succession, and right. I love the detail that the writers have, I think, a sort of a wealth advisor.
Yeah. Just
little things like, well, of course, none of them own coats, because why on earth would they need to be outside?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in novels as well, we're so preoccupied with wealth at the moment, and yeah. that's sort of a theme that kind of that comes and goes. And I think, you know, you're right, how could you write about that if you'd been really in it and among it and not sort of asked questions about it? Oh, have you read, I think it's called Angel by Elizabeth Taylor?
I don't think I have, no.
It's about a teenage novelist who becomes a superstar, but she is a nightmare. She is incredibly vulnerable and sort of hugely lovable, but not very likable. And she becomes very rich. And it's about how she sort of spends her money on various follies right. while sort of trying to, because in her head, because it all happened for her when she was about 17 or 18, that's sort of her idea of, you know, what it's like to be a billionaire yeah. has kind of frozen. And I think you do sort of see that, you know, in real life as well with celebrities and certain things that sort of you've always dreamed about that seem very fancy, even though they don't quite work. I'm trying to think of
a good example. Okay, so the example of, he's a bit less in the news these days, but the Andrew Tate thing. Mm. Anyone over the age of about, I don't know, 29, looks at Andrew Tate and thinks, God, this is embarrassing. How, you know, but there is a kind of supercar and supermodel, blah, 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 aspiration, caviar, cigar, guns, la, 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 you know. Like, most people of my age will think, geez, this is tragic. But when you're 15, you don't think like that.
Yeah.
You know, you do think, oh, wow, he's great. And so that's where a lot of the problem comes from. Yeah. Although I don't think anyone's tried to write him into a novel yet.
Well, I heard someone once say that Ferris Bueller, it is a nerd's idea of what popularity looks and feels like.
Gosh, that's interesting, because I love that film. I think I probably am the nerd that they're talking about when they're describing that. I saw it really late. I saw it when I was in my 20s. So I didn't see it when I was a teenager, but it would have had its maximum impact on me. But yeah, it is. You're right. It is a pretty kind of rudimentary, like, fantasy, and so charming.
Are there any books like that where you feel as though everyone sort of experienced them at a formative time as part of the fabric of them, and you read them late? I mean, I'm making air quotes, you can never really read a book late, but, you know, where you think, oh, is this
Yeah.
Like, I think about that with, you know, say the Beats and Kerouac, and reading them when I was at an impressionable age,
right.
and thinking, this is amazing. But had I read them after I was 25, I think I'd be like,
yeah,
what is this?
I bet there are all sorts like that. So I've never really read, I don't think I've read any Kerouac, actually, but I bet I wouldn't quite understand the thrill of it now. I mean, a big example would be D.H. Lawrence, I guess. Reading Lady Chatterley now probably doesn't have the kick. That's partly because society's changed, but, you know.
Even as a teenager, I think I had to reread quite a lot of Lady Chatterley's Love.
Right.
Are they having sex? Or what's going on here? It's just so dense.
Yeah, 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 exactly, yeah.
I adore Jilly Cooper, and I binged those books when I was a teenager, and I love them and reread them still. But I know people who've read them after turning 30 who have struggled a bit with the kind of unreconstructed sexism and the Tory politics,
yeah.
and the way that, oh, I mean, Jilly is just a divine and wonderful human being and one of the kindest and loveliest people, and I will love those books forever. But her feminism, or the way she depicts feminists, it's a bit viz.
Right. Well, I
sort of hairy-legged, shouty people.
Imagine if she got a kind of like good old fashioned Roald Dahl rewrite, like the kind that's been very, people have been very worried about recently, there would be nothing left, I imagine. The books would all be about 30 pages long if they got a thorough publisher's treatment, I guess.
I don't know how I feel about that. You know, I want everyone to be able to read books in a way where they feel seen and shown. And certainly we had Mallory Blackman on this podcast. And she told me that it wasn't until she was 22 and there was a bookshop in London that mostly sold the work of black writers. Mm. And she just only really been able to read books about white people. And she was a voracious reader and, you know, had a difficult time growing up and, you know, at home, and books were everything for her. And it was difficult to hear. I don't believe anyone should read a book and feel excluded by that, whatever that looks and feels like. But then I don't know that the answer is going back and fixing things. I think, well, let's just write more.
Yeah, I think that's probably where I come in on it. I mean, I have almost nothing relevant to say here as a middle-class white bloke. You know, my opinion is really not very at all important to this debate. I think I feel a bit twitchy about going back and sanitizing works that unwittingly were representations of an uglier time. So there's a great, actually, it's another Persephone. It's called Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day, right? It's this charming, it's a gorgeous book. It's about this, it's 24 hours in the life of this kind of quiet, downtrodden woman who stumbles into a new world and has a whirlwind. And it's literally all in 24 hours. It's like a proto version of the Jack Bauer TV show, except it's lovely. And, you know, it's a comic fantasy.
Andrew, I could not love you more for comparing Miss Pettigrew Lives for a Day with 24. That's brilliant.
But okay, so it's this amazing book, right? And it's got this one moment of clunking, thumping anti-Semitism in it, and it's like a character opens the door, and it's something like he had the dark, dark, menacing features of a Jew, and you go, what? And you look back at when this was published, and you realise it was published in 1938, and you think, wow, and that's being published in England in 1938, so it kind of reminds you of the time in which it was written and what was acceptable and unacceptable. I don't think there would have been a huge discussion with the author about, you know, should you include that line, should you not? So I think that is telling us something. Weirdly, I think that is a reason for kind of keeping the text as it is, the kind of retain and explain model. Where it comes into conflict with that's one book by one author who was writing in the 30s. Mm. When it comes into contact with the big global megacorp, like the Dahl Estate or the Fleming Estate or whatever, or the Blyton Estate, you know, all of these authors are, as far as their publishers are concerned, still huge going concerns. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, publishers have been editing Blyton and Christie's works since the 60s and you know, tweaking them in that sense. So, yeah, that's a funny one. I mean, you'd probably be pretty shocked if you read a lot of original Blyton or Christie today. Is that a reason to let it go and to write new things and read new things? Probably, yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Andrew soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week. I've chosen Seven Exes by Lucy Vine. Lucy is my friend, and I'm a huge fan of her writing. This takes a classic premise,
Who is the one who got away and takes it for a very smart spin as Esther tries to retrace her romantic path? It's slick, smart and lovable. The most fun summer read, but with depth and stealth wisdom too. If you love Lucy like I do, tickets are available for our Cambridge Waterstones event in a couple of weeks. And we'll also be hanging out with another podcast alumnus, Lindsay Kelk, at a July event. Details to be announced. Now, back to Andrew.
I love this idea of subscribing as well, of having your, just knowing what you're going to read.
Yeah.
Because I do find it hard to kind of to choose and to decide. Do you try to be varied in your reading habits?
Yeah, I do. I read a lot of almost all fiction. I read a lot of non-fiction for my work in various ways. So I feel like I've got that covered in my working life. And that means the rest of the time is free for fiction. I do try and get a range of periods and genres in. I'm an anti-genreist. I don't like being told, you like this, therefore you're going to read 37 more things like it now. I think that's a mad way of proceeding, but it completely varies. It's recommendations from friends, or I've just joined a book club for the first time, which is great fun. My friends and I have set one up, and so there you're reading on Ooh. Recommendations, and that again goes between Sylvia Plath and something that was published last year. So it's a range.
What are you reading at the moment in your book club?
We are reading A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles.
Ooh,
yeah,
former guest of the podcast.
Get out of here.
We went to his place. He's got a fabulous apartment in Gramercy Park.
I bet he has.
A lot of Ian Fleming first editions.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you do something sensible, like work in finance for 20 years before becoming a novelist. That's the way to do it. Yeah. I find first edition buying fascinating as a... I don't think if you gave me the... I did see a first edition of Emma recently. That was pretty exciting at someone's house.
Someone's house?
Yeah.
Like the Queen's house.
I was at the Queen's house and... no, it was just a friend who... I think it wasn't a first. It was a very early edition. And it was in three volumes, you know, that because they published them like that. And that was... Yeah, it was a thrill.
That's an incredible
I can understand it. Maybe it's the kind of thing I don't want to get into because I know I'd lose myself
sort of
to it.
See where it ends.
Yeah, it ends with me living in my car, but with a first edition of The Great Gatsby or whatever. Yeah,
a trunk. Well, I give them as gifts, and I've been lucky enough to get them as gifts, but nothing sort of. I've got a Nora Ephron essay collection in a first edition that I think she signed, and.
Nice.
A friend was very excited to see it, and I had to rescue it because he was reading it and he had a bottle of beer that he was sort of resting on the pages. I'm not pink funny, but could you please not do that?
Oh God. Yeah, that's agonizing.
So yeah, nothing but heartache. Don't go there.
Yeah.
What would you love a first edition of if I could? I mean, what I'd love to do, which I can't do, is give you the gift. Thank you for being on the podcast. I'm going to get you the hypothetical first edition of anything you like.
I'll tell you what, I'll go and get something off my shelf now if you give me 2 seconds.
Of course.
Recently, someone was looking for a present for me and they found a first edition of Douglas Adams's So Long and Thanks for All the Fish.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that is the one where Arthur Dent falls in love and it's wonderful. And My friend knows what a big Douglas Adams fan I am. He was waiting for a signed first edition of So Long and Thanks for All the Fish to come up on eBay, and he's a big eBay fan. Oh no, hang on, sorry, it's a second. No, never mind. But
is it a first paperback edition?
Yes, it is. It is. It's a first paperback edition. You're absolutely right. And the one he found is dedicated to Andrew. That's.
Oh my goodness, that's
And he'd
incredible.
Been waiting for years for any signed So Long and Thanks for the Fish to come up. And that was that's pretty special. So I think that's the one I'd go for, and I've already got it, which is lovely.
And it's a lovely, lovely thing to have. I love those old Pan Mac editions as well.
Yeah,
that is
gorgeous.
That 70s that was or 80s.
This is 85 it was published. Yeah. 1985. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Year of I was born.
That's it.
Oh, I'm delighted that you have that.
Mission accomplished.
I wanted to ask you about the nonfiction. Are there any books that you've had to read for work and then gone out and told all your friends, you must read this, it's brilliant? Is there anything that's been a real pleasure?
We have quite a lot of authors on No Such Thing as a Fish. And one author we had on a year or two ago is Mary Roach. And she writes books which are on scientific subjects. They're about a field of human experience. And she does a lot of amazing first-hand research. So there's Stiff, which is all about what happens to our bodies after we die. There's Bonk, which is the interactions between science and sex. Her latest one is about animals and the law and how they collide with each other. And I think it's called Animal Vegetable Criminal.
Nice.
Which is brilliant.
Very nice.
Yeah. Or it might be called The Fuzz over here. I can't remember. There are two titles on the either side of the Atlantic. Her books are amazing. They're really good because she really does the research. I think she had to have sex with her husband inside an MRI machine to do a study of some kind of fluid mechanics of sex. And her account of the experience is very, very funny. Or with an ultrasound scientist present, and it was just so awkward. But she puts herself into these amazing situations to get the stories for her book. She's a brilliant writer.
Oh,
yeah,
she sounds fantastic.
Ah, she's great. Yeah,
I think my friend Rowan Pelling of Perspective magazine. I was going to say formerly of the Erotic Review, and poor Rowan. Would like people to maybe not sort of say, oh, that job that you did 10 odd years ago, still how we're defining you. But I think she was on her own, but I think she went into an MRI to sort of record like what happens to the brain when you orgasm. And I'm just imagining this particular MRI machine in this sort of team of researchers standing around waiting, who's gonna show up and go in the machine today.
Well, you're really casting me back to an episode of Fish we did. I think the whole point of the MRI in that case is that you have to keep your head incredibly still. And I think there was someone who, one of the women who did this, I don't think it was Rowan, she had to train herself to have an orgasm, but while not moving her head, a muscle, so that the brain scans work. And I think she did it by tying a cat bell to her forehead. So that if there was any possible movement, the cat bell would go off. And
wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, the things people do for research, you know.
And I love that because that...
How do we get it's, here? How do we get
science,
onto this?
It's science, but it's quite DIY.
It's very DIY, yeah. We were talking about Evelyn Waugh and Gatsby a little bit ago. How do we get here? This is there's no such thing as a fish talking. It just goes there.
I love it. It's often what happens on this podcast as well. It's a thing of... joy. It makes me very happy. But I'm very glad you mentioned Evelyn Waugh again. Let's talk about him.
Oh, okay. I mean, brilliant.
As long
brilliant,
as you want to.
Brilliant comic author. I do. Yeah. Incredible. Early ones, amazing. Later ones, when it's all about being a Catholic, not quite for me. But
a little bit more heavy going.
Slightly heavier weather. Yeah, yeah. But I did read his Second World War, I nearly said Third World War, trilogy.
He didn't. The good news is that he's still alive. The bad news is...
but the Second World War trilogy, the Sword of Honor trilogy, which is actually nothing like it. It sounds incredibly grand. And it's about Guy Crouchback and his just terrible experiences across the whole Second World War. They are amazing. And they're late works, but they're very funny late works. Whereas... sorry, did you have a question about what? I feel like I just trampled in and started mouthing off. Oh, great.
That's great. Let's talk about the Sword of Honor trilogy, because I think I was a real fangirl for War when I was a teenager.
Me too. Me too as a teenager, yeah. But the early ones, things like Vile Bodies and Scoop.
Yes.
Yeah.
I still think... Is it Decline and Fall?
That's the first one, yeah.
Where he goes to prison.
Yes.
And he's about to get married, and he sort of he says there's just a bit of him, like, all his life just wanted to go to prison, and it's actually quite relaxing. I still think that's one of the funniest books I've ever read.
It is. He's, yeah, and there's a real lightness until, I think it's the end of the second book that Evelyn Waugh wrote, and just as he was getting to the end of Vile Bodies, I think his wife left him. And it was a really shattering experience for him, and the book takes an incredibly dark turn. Suddenly, and that kind of infused everything else that Waugh wrote. Yeah, he writes about a world, and it's a world that's really alien to us now. But the way he writes his books, where characters will kind of refer to characters in other books, you get the sense of like a social milieu that's happening and ongoing and evolving and shifting, and he's just zooming in on a particular bit. So Amanda Craig writes novels like that. And I started reading books by Simon Raven. The Rich Pay Late was the first one. And
it's really great. I don't know Simon Raven.
It is. They're 60s-ish and they are so, so dated now. I mean, and it's all about people behaving appallingly. And in the 60s, people really behave appallingly.
Oh,
you know,
I bet they did.
Like, there's a lot of... They're quite offensive in lots of ways. But he's writing the same thing. He's writing about a world with, you know, lots of moving parts. And everyone kind of knows everyone else. And I think those are really interesting series of books. I really like reading those where you think, oh, hang on, you were briefly referred to in A Handful of Dust. I know something about you. And, you know, now we're going to get more of your life. I think it's amazing if you can do it and get it right. Really
with
cool.
That and reading even more in Nancy Mitford, and that feeling of sort of doors being left ajar, and yeah. You can see it's like being at a child when your parents are having a dinner party and hearing certain conversations and trying to make sense of them, and you can sort of see things,
yeah,
you know, just happening kind of in the foreground. And I think, and I was going to say that Nancy Mitford's world feels a lot more frivolous, but I don't think that's true or fair when you think of how, you know, they are in it, and
I think it is. I'm not a Mitford fan. Anti Mitford is a bit strong, isn't it? But I they definitely don't speak to me. There's something about them that I find sets my teeth on edge a bit.
Oh, that's interesting. Is it the creakiness of the family?
I think it is. I think it's also like our current cultural genuflection towards the Mitfords. I mean, it's unfair to compare them to Boris Johnson's family. Like, they can't answer back, they can't hit back. But the whole thing of one of them's a Nazi and one of them's a communist and one of them's you know, in society, and well, they're all in society, but there is a sense in which it's a bit like Succession. You know, the play focuses on this incredibly small core of people, and we're not really interested in the rest of the world. And, you know, in Succession, the billionaires get all the best lines. And the same is true in Mitford's stuff. And it's, I mean, that's partly because she was writing it, so that's fair enough. But I don't know. I do want a bit more interaction between the unit and the world. It's kind of like how in Star Wars, you get a lot of focus on internal Skywalker family politics, when actually there's a whole galaxy out here, guys. You know, obviously that's the most interesting from a dramatic point of view. It's why King Lear is about King Lear and his daughters rather than the state of England in that year. You know, I get it.
Which brings us back to Succession.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's the new novel, you know, the TV series, apparently. So
I'm in the wrong job.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that is interesting, because given our other sort of points of reference, and again, I think I read The Pursuit of Love when I was 12 and I was supposed to be revising for an exam, and I read it instead.
That's fertile Mitford territory.
And I wonder whether it's a bit like, you know, I suppose my YA, if right. I were to come to Mitford at, you know, my 20s or 30s, I would have been like, this makes me want to revolt.
Yeah, I think maybe that's what... Yeah. I came in at that point, yeah.
I suppose perhaps it's because I've got five younger sisters and we grew up in the countryside. And I love that middle of nowhere feeling, and that there's a bit where Fanny and Linda are just, they're sort of, I think, in their early teens, and they just want to fall in love and escape, and they have these crushes, and Linda is in love with the Prince of Wales, and Fanny is in love with a local farmer, and they know nothing about these men, and they will never meet them, but they just feel where all their, the only way to kind of escape and have any kind of life is to fall in love, and their idea of love is very romantic, that, you know, they don't think of it in terms of, you know, as was the style at the time, like, oh, we've got to be practical about this.
But what you've identified there, that's the bit of the human experience. Like, you love that bit because it sounds like you know about growing up in the countryside in part of a large family of girls, and yeah, when you are young and just starting to find out about, you know, fancying people, you're so clueless. You've got no idea, you know, and you've got absolutely no idea what what to say, do, whether you're doing this right, wrong, and that. So clearly, there's an element of the human experience which she's nailed, and that is the whole point of reading. You know,
it's that pin the tail on the donkey feeling of it as well. Like, I've got this enormous bundle of feelings, and I've got to pin them on someone. You'll do.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I've just been rereading Happy All the Time by Laurie Colwyn, which I adore. I don't know if you've ever come across her, but there's a brilliant line where she talked, but it's sort of about two men and the women they marry, and that's pretty much it. And it is incredibly funny, but and one character, Misty, realizes she has fallen in love. She identifies it as being a crisis, that she says that I've sort of all my life I've been waiting for the thing to happen. I felt like something in my life is about to start and it hasn't started yet, and this is it starting. And she has a kind of grief for the fact that even though something wonderful is happening, she's losing that possibility and that potential of the before.
I think about this a lot. I think about the doors that close as the others open, and it can be the most amazing door in the world that's opening. It depends on your temperament. All of us will think a little bit about the doors that we moved past on the way to the doors we eventually went through. Yeah, I'm writing something, not the next book, I'm writing the one after that, is largely about that. Yeah. Because it's a really, really universal element of all our lives, I think. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, I'm talking and enthusing a lot about a kind of book that I haven't ended up writing myself. And that's strange, I think. As in, I've written kind of two big end of the worldy, and they're definitely set in a very potentially fraught environment. And yet, the things that I admire and the bits that I try to fit in there are the human bits within that. You know, I think that's the thing that I most love about reading, is you find a little piece of human experience, whatever that is, and you can make it sing when you're writing and when you're reading and whatever you pick up on, because you, as the writer, you can't control what people pick up on. If you find a way of writing something that speaks to people, you know, the smaller bit the better, then that's the dream, I think.
Well, I suppose that's exactly what Douglas Adams has done, where if you sort of describe any of those books, there's nothing, they don't sound like they're going to be about how human lives are lived. They're, you know, being in space and but actually that's all they're about, is those different human experiences and how does it feel and what's it like. Hypothetically, are there any books you've read where a character has made a big decision and you would, for fun, like to rewrite them with the character making the opposite decision and kind of the story becoming different? If you could play Choose Your Own Adventure with it.
Yeah, and I used to read a lot of those books when I was tiny. I loved them. The Citadel of Chaos and all the others. They were brilliant. I'm now looking at my shelves for inspiration to see which ones. My eyes just landed on Dune, but I don't think Dune, where the main character just sort of quietly accepts that his family have lost the throne and, you know, goes and lives in the desert and occasionally rides one of the worms. I don't think that would be a good...
I would love a Pride and Prejudice sequel. I don't know, where Mrs. Bennet turns on Mr. Bennet and says, you know, it's not working and you're an idiot, and goes off and has a sort of... Well, comes into weird, like, obscure family money, and she goes off to Bath and has a jolly time.
I think I researched this once. I think there are a couple of hundred Pride and Prejudice sequels, and they're all so different. So you've got P.D. James, who wrote Death Comes to Pemberley, you know, murder mystery. And then there's one where Elizabeth Darcy, as she would have become, is widowed and then has to defend England from a Napoleonic invasion with a fleet of hot air balloons. There's that one.
I don't know about that one.
It does sound good. It does sound really good. I've seen the kind of not very good looking 60s cover of it and not quite decided to dip in. Okay, so one of the main choices in life is who you end up with or don't. And there is a brilliant novel by Edith Wharton called The House of Mirth, which is all about Lily Bart, she's a young woman. She's, in early 20th century terms, she's well past her prime at the age of about something like 34 or something crazy like that. You know, but like, she's getting to the point where, as a young, very marriageable woman, she has to make a decision. And there's someone again, it's another anti-Semitism klaxon. There's a financier who's Jewish and described in quite unflattering terms as that, who she decides not to marry. And there are a couple of other people she decides not to marry. And the book is about her life, where she falls between a few different stools of marriage and what happens to her, without giving anything away. I'd love to read a story of what happened if she had chosen a different path, because, yeah, it's a brilliant novel. And Wharton's kind of very Austen-y. It's set in a world of extreme wealth, but you're seeing the human consequences of and the human unhappiness at the heart of it, and that makes it empathetic. No matter how incredibly lavishly wealthy the characters are, you're seeing their lives and their pain, and that's what we want. In fact, the wealthier they are, the more we want to see their pain.
Bring them down. I would love to read that. Would you write it?
No, I don't think I would. I'm simultaneously too aware that I'm not as good as Wharton, and too, I'm a bit of a purist sometimes about, as in I like reading the originals by authors, and, you know, and I think it's tough setting yourself up as, you know, as writing in the Wharton tradition. I'm definitely inspired by lots of people, though, and, you know, lots of things I write are pretty clearly inspired by other authors in the same kind of field, like Wyndham or like P.D. James or whoever, but be frightened of that. And also, vainly, I want to write my own characters, you know.
I think that's a very good point. Andrew, I've loved talking to you so much. It's been such a joy to have you on here. Very sadly, we must draw this to a close. Before we go, are you allowed to tell us anything about the upcoming books? Or not?
Actually, yes, I am, because we are because in the back of the paperback of The Sanctuary, in brackets, available all good bookshops now, there is a little preview of the third book. Do you remember, you know, do you know that thing where you get to the end of a book and then there's a first chapter of the next one? That's the first time this has ever happened to me, and I love that when I read it. I get so excited. So, yeah, I won't say the title because I think the title's going to change. But basically.
So the title I've put in here. The title that's going to be in sale in your bookshops. Is,
The one...
I think we've got that in when my novel Careering just came out in paperback. Yeah. And there's a thing in the back for Limelight, the novel that's coming out in June, with the cover, which, again, because I remember that when I was a child reading, I thought, oh, that's so exciting.
Yeah.
But I think there is a tiny, tiny, tiny mistake, a missed apostrophe or something plural that shouldn't be plural,
no.
I can't remember.
Pulp them all.
Pulp them all. if anyone listening can spot that in their copy of Careering, I will, like, get in touch. I will send you, first one to spot the mistake, I'll send you a Limelight.
That's great. the third one is, and again, I like to think that the ending of The Sanctuary is very exciting and gripping, and then suddenly you're going to have a completely different start to a new novel. Basically, the third book is going to be about a young man and a few of his friends, and they spend their time, they live in the empty second homes of the wealthy without their knowledge, without the owner's knowledge, and it's about the wonderful life they have and how it all goes very badly wrong for them somewhere around chapter 3.
That sounds excellent. So are they like property guardians, or are they squatting?
Not even. They're uninvited house sitters. I think they reject the label squatters, but nonetheless, it's pretty clearly a description of what they're doing. Yeah, so it's about that. And it's basically a way of writing about young people and housing, but with the body in the middle of it too.
That sounds fabulous. I'm really excited about that. And this is one of the best books list we've ever had. I've got so much reading to do. I'm so excited.
I know. I've got a lot of hot tips here. I'm very excited.
Good thank to go you so into much for world me. Of Whipple. Thank you for coming on. I've absolutely loved it. Huge thanks to Andrew. The Sanctuary is published by Penguin and out now. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can find all the books that Andrew mentioned at acast.com/booked, and you can see a selection at bookshop.org. You can find us and follow us on social media at WhyBooked. Huge thanks to everyone who has given us a 5-star review. We really, really appreciate it. If you haven't done it yet, it's a brilliant way to help people to find the podcast and their new favourite book. Finally, I leave you with this from Dorothy Parker. I don't want to review books anymore. It cuts in too much on my reading. See you next time.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.